This is a Thursday edition of Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums. The 12th annual Arkansas Poll is out. The annual survey of Arkansas adults about politics, the quality of life, and other topics is conducted every year by the Survey Research Center at the University of Arkansas. This year's poll included 771 telephone surveys conducted by trained interviewers. Janine Perry is the director of the Arkansas Poll. She's also a professor of political science at the University of Arkansas. Yesterday afternoon, she came to the Carver Center for Public Radio to discuss this year's edition of the Arkansas Poll.
Ideally, kind of the gold standard of polling and public opinion collection is that everybody has an equal odds, right, of being called. So that's what we're doing. We have refined over the years, you know, it's really the Survey Research Center and Dr. Molly Longstreth who do that, but we've really kind of tried to refine over the years when we call and when we don't call. Because, of course, if you just call in the middle of the afternoon, the age of your average respondent, mm-hmm. as well as the job status of your average respondent, tends to, be of a certain variety. So we tend to get usually older, retired white males. That's who seems to be home in the afternoon and willing to talk to us. So we try to call in the evening, undoubtedly around the dinner hour at times. We try not to call too late in the evening. We try not to start too early in the morning. We also figured out after our very first year that we shouldn't call on Saturday afternoons while the Hogs are playing. It turns out that's not an ideal time to hear from the University of Arkansas.
You could always, how many people are annoyed by people who call during Razorback games?
Exactly.
100%.
And we had to stop doing that or we would have had to add that question to our protocol for sure.
Questions, some that the Survey Center comes up with, but you ask for questions.
We do a call for questions. So we have a common battery of demographics, educational attainment and income, race and ethnicity. Do you consider yourself evangelical? How often do you go to church? You know, what church are you affiliated with or what, you know, brand of religion, I guess, what denomination? All kinds of things. Really a much more detailed battery than you see on most polls. And that's partly so we can do it for analysis, for scholarship. It's partly also so we can assess the representativeness of our sample. There are lots of reasons we do it. So those are pretty standard. But, you know, the rest of it is devoted to all kinds of policy questions. And we do try to do repeated batteries so we can track things over time. But we also try to add fresh things or do a new twist on something because maybe in the environment, the way we talk about it, the way the question is framed has changed. Or a totally new, of course, issue has come onto the scene. And then, of course, there's another standard battery toward the beginning, which is where we do approval ratings for public officials, the sort of highest profile folks, president, governor, U.S. senators, generally speaking. We may be, most years, we do some kind of head-to-head contest. If there's a top-of-the-ticket kind of race, we'll do one or more of those. And then, of course, we also standard batteries on partisanship. You know, generally, how do you see yourself? You know, Democrat, Republican, independent, or what? And ideology. So, you know, there are a lot of things that just are the same. There are some things that we put on for our own research interests in the Department of Political Science. And then we do this just all call in the summer, really to collaborating researchers at the University of Arkansas. So we've collaborated with nursing professors, accounting professors, psychology professors, criminal justice professors, education professors, just a host of all kinds of different folks who might have a policy relevant question that we can help them out with. So we love those collaborations. They've proved really fruitful.
One of the collaborations this year was about health.
Yes, and really we hope that's just a teaser to a longer project. We work with Dr. John Gaber, who just joined our department, and he's been doing some work with some of the public actors in the state on obesity. And what are people's perceptions of obesity? And then we can of course look at what kind of communities they live in and that kind of thing. So one of the things he asked about indeed was, you know, is it a significant problem in your community? And we had two questions, both for adult and child obesity, and overwhelmingly people did either strongly agree or agree that it was a compelling problem in their community. So we think that's a really nice teaser for maybe a more elaborate battery next year to do something in which Arkansas has been a leader, I suppose, in both the good and the bad respect, right? We have a greater than average problem with obesity here, but also, you know, certainly under Governor Mike Huckabee's leadership and some of the state legislators, we've also tried to tackle the problem in ways that have been noteworthy nationally and internationally. So I think Dr. Gaber has a really great idea to maybe kind of build on that tradition, build on that foundation.
Yeah, the number of people who said, yes, obesity was a problem in their community was high,
it's
more than 3/4.
Yeah, it's 80%+ for both child and adult. So we don't get findings like that very often.
You asked about self-identification again this year. Are you a Democrat, Republican? Both major parties in Arkansas seem to have lost people who are willing to admit that they're part of those parties.
Yeah, I think that's really interesting, because if there's one thing I've noticed over the years, it's that there's been remarkable stability in people's self-declared identification with one party or the other, or as independents. It's typically been between 22% and 28% Republican identifiers, between maybe 32% and 40% Democratic identifiers, and then between maybe 33%, 34% to 40% independent identifiers. This year, you know, you might sort of think that the Republican identifiers would have taken off, you know, given the cues in the broader climate and what's happening, and that the Democrats would have gone down and, you know, the independents might have stayed about the same. That's not at all what happened. The Republicans actually declined to 21%, the lowest that we recorded. The Democrats also took a significant hit. I think it was the lowest we recorded for them. Independent affiliation, I guess if you want to call it that way, affiliation, actually skyrocketed to the highest we recorded. I think we did it at about, clocked it at 41% or 42%. So that was really interesting, because there's just been so much stability for 11 years, and then this year, right, finally it looked significantly different. And then, of course, we followed up, right, with the independents, which we do every year. So we kind of, you know, get real close to them on the phone and say, no, really, you can tell me. Do you consider yourself closer to the Republican Party, the Democratic Party, or are you just an independent? And again, almost, I mean, with very little change from year to year, even in previous election years, they basically break out into very rough thirds. You know, a third say, well, I'm more Republican, a third say more Democrat, and a third say just independent. This year, that was really the marked thing, or an equally marked thing. The independents swung hard to the right. And when you narrow our sample down to just very likely voters, we got fully 50% of those folks to say, well, I am an independent, but I feel closer to the Republican Party. Now, the big question is, well, is that at least right now, right? Or is that the beginning of some long-term pattern that we've all been looking for in my profession, right, for at least 20 years? So we'll see.
Yeah, I would imagine if I was candidate gray or candidate drown for the U.S. Senate, I'd be encouraged, but that doesn't necessarily translate.
I fear it doesn't. Just the way that our electoral rules are set up, and you know, therefore we get this two-party dominance. It probably doesn't say much for a falling away from the parties in general, right, to some kind of third or fourth or just minor party alternative. I fear probably it just means we're in some kind of transition between the two parties. It could be temporary, it could be permanent. That remains to be seen.
Arkansas adults appear not to be big fans of health care reform that was passed by Congress.
Yeah, that was really interesting this year, too. I mean, on the one hand, it was what we expected. Arkansans aren't that far off the mainstream with most of America and most of the public policy questions we've asked over the years. So, again, we get a strong majority of people who disapproved of the way we phrased it, I think, was the health care law that was enacted last March. You know, given what you've read or heard, you know, do you strongly approve, disapprove, strongly disapprove? And we got an overwhelming majority that fell in that disapprove, strongly disapprove category. What I just sort of stumbled upon, I'm embarrassed to say, but we've been doing this for so long, right? We've completed 10,000 interviews, and we ask, you know, typically 70 questions each time. I had forgotten that we did a fairly large healthcare battery in 2004, and I'm not even sure I can remember why. It may have been one of my colleagues who was interested in that policy at the time, but I happened to be looking at it because I was looking at some of Senator Lincoln's numbers from 2004, the last time she was up for re-election. So I stumbled across these healthcare numbers, and when we asked, now granted, it was a much broader question, and it was in a different time, but in 2004, when we said to people, and there was a prelude to the question, so I think there's a big priming influence here, but we said, you know, basically 22% of Arkansans don't have health insurance of Arkansas adults. You know, would you favor, you know, extending insurance to them? More than 80% of our sample in 2004 said yes. Well, that's kind of easy in the abstract, especially with the priming. So a couple questions later, we said, well, how about a tax increase? Would you be willing to support a tax increase? And more than 60% of the sample said yes. Well, fast forward 6 years and one really foul economy later, and we're nowhere near that. And a very concrete proposal, you know, which in some ways maybe was what people thought, in some ways not what people thought. You know, there's a lot to like, there's a lot to dislike for almost anyone out there, and we get a very different result. So just as someone who likes to look at long-term patterns or try to make something of that, I thought that was particularly interesting.
Janine Perry is the director of the Arkansas Poll and a professor of political science at the University of Arkansas. The 12th annual Arkansas Poll was released yesterday. It was conducted, as it is every year, by the Survey Research Center at the University of Arkansas. You can hear more from our conversation, including what most concerns Arkansans, at ozarksatlarge.com. Also at our webpage, a link to the entire 2010 Arkansas poll. This is Ozarks at Large. This year's marquee political race signals some big shifts for Arkansas. Pundits say it's likely Republican Congressman John Bozeman will topple incumbent U.S. Senator Blanche Lincoln on Tuesday. From Little Rock, Kelly McNeil spoke to the candidates by phone as they crisscrossed the state in their last-minute campaign rush.
The big issue in this Senate race, like many races around the country, isn't the sexiest. It isn't foreign wars or education policy or abortion. It's money, what the federal government is spending and whether or not it should. Listen to the way Lincoln contrasts herself with Bozeman on support of Arkansas farmers.
He talks a big game about agriculture, but push comes to shove, he's not there voting for the disaster assistance or the things that, you know, that they really need.
In other words, she's daring Bozeman to put the money where his mouth is. Bozeman, meanwhile, says those dollars, whether they go to farmers, health clinics, or elsewhere, are often not a good expenditure.
Senator Lincoln and I just disagree on the basic concept of what's the right approach. I don't believe that you can tax and spend and borrow your way to prosperity, and that's what's come out of the administration, and Senator Lincoln has supported that 95% of the time.
Lincoln says she wants to balance the budget and helped do so during the Clinton administration, but she's also reminding Arkansas voters that she has a record of bringing home the bacon. She routinely recites lists of local projects that were enabled by federal dollars.
You know, I think people are appreciative of that. These are dollars and projects that have been on the books for a long time, and these are dollars that would have been spent in other states had we not worked hard, and as a delegation, if I hadn't worked hard with Senator Pryor to get those dollars in here.
But if residents are appreciative, it's not showing up in polls. Bozeman says clout of the kind Lincoln has accumulated in Washington is useless unless it's deployed in the right direction.
The reality is that the health care bill is a very, very bad law. The budgets that have been passed have tremendously increased the deficit. And again, those things, regardless, they're still bad bills, and the people of Arkansas have rejected it.
Lincoln did vote for the federal stimulus and health care overhaul, but she's tried to distance herself from the Obama administration in this race.
I think Arkansans are independent-minded, and I think I know I'm independent-minded. I'm probably the most independent voice in Washington right now, and I'm going to challenge whether it's the administration or the Democratic caucus or the Republican caucus if they're trying to do something that's not good for Arkansas.
Lincoln is also trying to turn the focus away from her onto Bozeman and what he may do if he wins the Senate seat.
You know, there's big differences in the choices that are there, and these differences matter. My opponent wants to put a 23% sales tax on everything you buy, from your house and cars to washing powder and your bread and milk.
She's referring to the fair tax, which would replace the current income tax. Lincoln says it would hurt the working class disproportionately. Bozeman says it could do away with the IRS, though he won't commit to sponsoring any particular proposal.
But the system that we have right now is very unfair, and it's very complex.
Bozeman was criticized by one columnist recently for adhering too closely to the Republican line, whatever it may be. Bozeman says that's not really accurate.
I've disagreed in a number of different issues. President Bush, I disagreed very much with his stance on illegal immigration. I'm very much against amnesty, very much for trade with Cuba. That would be great for the state.
The most recent poll by the University of Arkansas shows Bozeman with a wide lead over Lincoln. Nonetheless, Lincoln insists that things are tightening up and that she can win the Senate seat once again on Tuesday.
Kelly McNeil of KUAR in Little Rock with that report. This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums. With me in the Anthony and Susan Hoy News Studio is Bo Counts, who is the president of Artemis. Bo, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
Artemis, in case people don't know, is what? How would I say it? Roughly an artist collective?
Yeah, that's a really good way of putting it. It's a collective that we established several years ago to give opportunities to emerging Arkansas artists. They don't exactly have to live here, but be from here or live here. And, you know, it's a really great way for us to give opportunities to these people that may not know where to start or, you know, have enough of a portfolio to get, you know, a big gallery show.
Filmmakers, photographers, sculptors, graphic artists,
musicians,
and fashion designers, right?
And fashion designers, yeah. And it's interesting that you mentioned that because we just wrapped up the very first Ozark Couture, which we partnered with Fayetteville Underground to do. It was last weekend. It was a fantastic, fantastic event and very, very successful. And it was a big experiment for us to really focus on fashion more because our big gallery events, the fashion element has kind of grown and everyone's really loved it. And we're like, how can we focus on this more? And to really do so, we felt we needed to pull it away. And by doing that, we were able to just channel all of our energy at it and really present fashion in a whole new way. And everybody responded positively to it. So we're going to kind of make this our fashion arm.
Now, Artemis 13.
Right around the corner. It is going to be November 10th in our usual location, the Dixon Street Theater. And we're currently accepting, you know, submissions for art and any kind of art. You know, we just mentioned that it's really important. Don't think that, hey, I made this thing out of like, you know, scrap metal and old cassette tapes and it really is important to me. That's art. You know, writing is art. Music is art. Everything is art. And if you created it and it's important to you, submit it. And you can find instructions right on our website at artemis.org.
And Artemis is not just for artists. It's for the people who want to see, hear, or touch the art as well.
Oh, yeah. It's more, you know, a lot of people think that we're trying to give exposure to the artists. But we're also trying to expose the community to new ways of looking at art, you know. Everybody's has an idea that art can be really stuffy or really boring. And, you know, right when we think that we've convinced everybody that's not the case, we find new people that go, oh, wow, this is really neat. This is really new and different. You know, they don't expect to see, you know, a bike made out of like feathers and, you know, all this weird wax. We had a piece that was created about, it was Mark. Oh, I forget his name, but...
Not Mark Krause.
Mark Krause, yes,
okay,
thank you.
Right, yeah.
Mark Krause, he made a motorcycle to kind of represent the Icarus, mm-hmm. and it had wings, and it was all made from found art. That's art. It's not a painting. It's not a sculpture. What is it? But it's still art, and that's the kind of stuff you're going to see at an Artemis event.
But I still, one time, was there and managed to find a Mother's Day gift for my mother. I couldn't afford nor do I think she'd have a place to put the motorcycle. But, you know, there are handbags, there are... Mm-hmm. There's art. It's the gamut.
It's the gamut. And like you just said, everything there's for sale. You can meet right with the artists. And, you know, one thing that's really cool about emerging artists is you can get them before they become really, really famous and their pieces are really, really expensive. So you can always find something that's affordable that makes a great Christmas gift or, you know, who knows what, just hanging on your mantle.
That's November 10th.
November 10th, Dixon Street Theater from 7 to 11.
And Halloween is Sunday, but now Friday night.
Friday night, I'm a man of many hats, and I'll be throwing the fourth annual Beatboxes Halloween Dance Party. It's another event that has just evolved into this huge monster, for you know an appropriate term. It's all about changing the space, you know, and I take that same mentality when I do an Artemis event to my for the Halloween party or the New Year's party. And it's going to be at Speakeasy this year, Friday night. Doors open at 9:30. And we're going to have the biggest costume party in Fayetteville for the fourth year in a row. We're going to change the space. You're going to see props. You're going to see tons of people in costumes. It's going to be like a mix of haunted house and dance party and nightclub atmosphere. And, you know, you won't forget it.
Costumes encouraged.
Strongly encouraged. You don't want to be that guy that walks in and, what's your costume? Oh, well, I forgot.
And you know what doesn't fly? Oh, I'm as a college student or I'm as a guy just off work.
Mm-mm.
Those don't work.
The greatest thing that I really love about the Halloween events that I put together is the creativity that comes out in some of these costumes. You go to the Halloween stores, you see all of these pre-made costumes that, you know, oh, well, okay, I'm a jailer or I'm a sexy jailer. And these people, you fill up a room with 400 people. And you see all this creativity, and you're like, they didn't go buy these costumes. They thought of really interesting and unique ideas, and it's really, really cool to see all that in one room.
But now, see, that intimidates me, because I always have grand plans. You ask me in late August, oh, I'm going to come up with something this year. And then, of course, it's October 29th, and I haven't done
anything. You don't have anything?
No, I don't know what I'm getting.
Oh, Kyle, come on.
So what, you as a veteran of someone who throws these Halloween parties, what advice would you give to someone like me who's just now beginning to think?
The best costumes I see are usually the ones that are created with things that are in your everyday life. If there's like a particular pop culture reference or a TV show character that you really, really love. I mean, last year I saw a lot of House, you know, House MD. Well, you need a sport coat, a cane, some Just for Men gray in your hair, and your house, you know, and it's very believable. And I think that when you find found objects that, you know, you normally don't think of as a Halloween costume prop, those make the best because they're real and not a cheap imitation knockoff that you find at a party store. So just look around you. There's Halloween ideas everywhere you go.
That's Speakeasy Friday night beginning at 9:30.
Beginning at 9:30. We're going to have music by, of course, myself, under my DJ moniker, Beatbox, Baby Army, and Nicholas Scott.
And then November 10th, Dixon Street Theater, that's Artemis 13.
Artemis 13. And deadline for submissions is November 5th.
And even if you've never submitted before to anybody, try it.
Try it. Try it. Nothing to lose. Only things to gain.
And online?
www.artemis.org.
Bo, thanks a lot.
It's a pleasure.
Bo Counts is the president of Art Amiss. Artemis 13 is November 10th at Dixon Street Theater in Fayetteville. The Artemis Halloween Party is tomorrow night at Speakeasy, also in Fayetteville. And if you want to hear more about Artemis, including the organization's approach to fashion and the possibility of an Artemis record label for local and regional musicians, you can hear an extended version of our conversation at OzarksAtLarge.com. This is Ozarks at Large. The historic 1886 Crescent Hotel and Spa in Eureka Springs has been dubbed one of the most haunted hotels in the country. Earlier this week, on a dark and stormy night, well, it was dark and windy, Ozarks at Large's Ithi Agnihotri-Madulkar took a tour of the Crescent.
Normally when we catch something on the thermal imaging camera, it's not very impressive.
Oh my gosh, hang on, I gotta look at that again before I start flipping out.
But there, staring us down, was this figure that was no more than 2 feet away from me, and honestly gave me chills. That kind of stuff just doesn't happen very often. It's the holy grail for us investigators.
The clip from the basic cable television show The Ghost Hunters visit to the Crescent Hotel and Spa in Eureka Springs, caught on tape, one of several ghosts that have been reported by guests and staff of the 114-year-old establishment. Glenn Cuvillon, supervisor of Crescent Hotel Ghost Tours, says the hotel has quite a spooky history.
This started out as a very exclusive hotel. The railroad, the Eureka Springs Improvement Company, which was kind of a branch started by the railroad, they needed a place for rich people to come and have their families come and spend money. It was built on a crescent-shaped stone outcropping, which gives the hotel its name today, the Crescent Hotel. And what they did initially to try to make money is they started a girls' college or a conservatory during the winter months, strictly, and did that for a while, had it as a hotel three-quarters of the year. Then they said, you know, it's less upkeep to have it as a girls' college. So let's just do that for year-round. And I think they did it a little over 10 years. Then the Depression hit. A man named Norman Baker drove up here in his beautiful purple car. He said he was a doctor, said he had a cure for cancer, said he wanted to help people and start a hospital. The only problem is, A, he wasn't a doctor. He was a con man who had been chased from state to state. A lot of folks passed away here, unfortunately.
The hotel has largely been preserved in its original form with the occasional change in furniture. The dry stack stone construction also adds to the mysterious charm of Crescent. Reportedly, several ghosts have been sighted here, of which about 12 to 18 are recognizable. Glenn says some of these spirits are confined to a particular room in the hotel. Others can be seen just about anywhere on the premises.
There are some very famous ones like Michael, who is based in 218, but he's been also seen out in the garden. Never by men, always by women. He's a big flirt, definitely. He meets more women than me, and he's dead. We also have Theodora, who is in 419. Theodora is a short, pleasingly plump woman who someone has told me reminds them of Aunt Bee, so of the Andy Griffith Show fame. And she plays little jokes. The ghosts here are very mischievous. There's nothing evil here as far as I see. There's no kind of activity like that.
The Crescent's ghostly activities had long been downplayed by past owners who feared losing business. Ghost tours at the hotel started in 1997 after the current owners embraced the spooky history of the place. Glenn says many non-believers in ghosts were converted when they experienced an unearthly touch or sound.
I have had many people on the tour who were non-believers at the start of the tour and changed their minds, especially if they either see something or what happens even more often than seeing something is they're touched. Usually, not always, down in the morgue. Whatever's down there, now I mentioned there's nothing evil here, whatever's down there seems to be grumpy. Does not seem to like us down there. It's like somebody, and people will feel pushed on their backs as if it wants them out of there. That seems to be the most active actual room here, 218, 419. There are a lot of other places that are active. Almost things have been seen and experienced in almost every room, though. But the morgue, I would say, with my experience, mostly the activity, there's a lot of activity down there.
Glenn takes us on a tour of some of the spooky spots in the hotel building. But first, he must get his ghost meter, or an electromagnetic field detector, used to detect peaks in electromagnetic fields that reportedly can be caused also by the presence of a spirit.
Reuben, can I get another battery? This one's getting kind of low.
He walks towards a flight of stairs where many years ago a little girl was found dead.
An area that we usually pick up something with the ghost meter is right here. This is where the little girl fell from up there. Oh yes, we don't always get a reading like this, but this is a pretty good one.
Glenn keeps walking. For a ghost tour supervisor, he has quite a sense of humor.
Ebro in Paris. My mom's embarrassed because it's April in Paris. For me. We don't charge for the singing, you can tell why.
He opens the door to the morgue.
Welcome to the morgue, my friends.
The morgue was used to keep bodies during the Norman Baker era. It has an autopsy table with a sink. Two little chambers that were used to store more bodies and body parts are attached to the morgue. It is in one of these chambers that TV's ghost hunters spotted a ghostly figure. Glenn decides to conduct an experiment.
Let me see if I can do a little experiment. Let me turn the lights off a little bit. All right. This doesn't always work. I'll find the null zone here. Getting a lot of electromagnetic radiation. If you have a major electromagnetic field that's moving around in the room, that should not be. So it doesn't lead you to a ghost, but it actually tells you if there's something unusual going on as far as electromagnetic radiation. But we have so many experiences, and many, many people have experiences down here in the morgue. And you can usually tell the ones who have actually seen something because suddenly the smile goes off of their face and they have a very pale look on their face. They usually are very spooked when they actually see something.
In order to be spooked, the Crescent Hotel ghost tour tickets can be purchased online on www.crescenthotel.com or at the hotel front desk in Eureka Springs. More information is available on 479-253-9766. For Ozarks at Large, this is Iti Agnihotri Mudholkar.
Cleo Lane was born on this date in 1927 in England. The British singer and actress mastered a variety of styles, but was best known as the Queen of Jazz. Lane was born to a Jamaican father and an English mother. She quit school at the age of 14 and took a variety of jobs while auditioning for singing jobs. Her first break came in 1951 when she was hired as a vocalist for the Johnny Dankworth Seven, a well-known jazz group. In her 7 years dedicated solely to performing with the group, she gained a large following and also began to record. In 1958, the year she married Dankworth, she took her first theatrical role in Flesh to a Tiger, set in Jamaica. Her success in the part led her to take on a number of other acting roles throughout the years, and she was a regular on the weekly BBC television satire, That Was the Week That Was. In the meantime, she continued to stretch herself as a singer, and was the only singer to receive Grammy nominations in jazz, popular, and classical categories. Lane was made an officer of the Order of the British Empire in 1979, and in 1985 was the first British singer to win a Grammy Award for Best Female Jazz Vocalist. She also performed in plays by Euripides and Shakespeare, and took part in musical theater. I'm so alone, so alone in this great big city. Oh, lady be good to me. On this date in 1989, Winkley Bridge at Turney's Ferry, one of the three bridges over the Little Red River, collapsed, killing five people. The bridge was known locally as Swinging Bridge and had become something of a tourist attraction after it was closed to vehicular traffic in 1972. The Statue of Liberty, a gift from the people of France, was dedicated in New York Harbor by President Grover Cleveland on this date in 1886. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
It's Thursday, October 28th, 2010. This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums. With me is Becca Bacon-Martin. She is the editor of What's Up. That's the tab you'll find in Northwest Arkansas newspapers tomorrow.
And you know, we talk about a reader's vocabulary.
Mm-hmm.
If you don't know what that is, that means that if you don't have to talk, you don't have to know how to say things.
Sure. I remember as a kid, what was the word? Chinook, the kind of fish. I thought it was pronounced a certain way until I said it out loud and someone told me I was incorrect.
Well, I'm about to really butcher somebody's name. There's a show at the Union Theater at the University of Arkansas in Fayetteville tonight. It's slam poetry and spoken word. It's called the Night Kite Revival Tour.
Mm-hmm.
Derek Brown, Buddy Wakefield, and Anas Mojani, which I probably butchered. 7 o'clock at the Union Theater, and it's free.
Just walk in.
You don't have to be a student. Just walk in. Also tonight, I can say this, a New York-based quartet called Ethel comes to Sportsmith 2nd Street Live. 7:30, the group will perform the Philip Glass-written score of the movie The Hours.
That's pretty cool.
I see Kyle out the door now.
That's pretty cool.
Tickets are $35. 2nd Street Live is a small venue.
But really, really good venue.
Really good venue. But I would not just show up at the door.
No,
I'd
point. Call ahead, yes.
And that's 719-8783. As we said yesterday, Imogene, an original play by Bob Stevenson, is back for the second of two free performances at 7:30 at Breedlove Auditorium at the University of Arkansas at Fort Smith. And You're in Town continues at University Theater in Fayetteville. Tony Award-winning play, funny title, funny show, great cast, great direction, great set. Go see it, 8 o'clock.
Becca Bacon-Martin is the editor of What's Up, found in Northwest Arkansas newspapers. This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums. With me is P.J. Hrabowski, music director at KUAF. It's time to talk about tomorrow's edition of Film Score Friday, 10 to noon,
exactly.
Tomorrow morning.
Special Halloween Film Score Friday,
well,
of course.
I would hope so.
Yeah.
So what are you highlighting for us today?
Okay, I thought I'd highlight one of my favorite. It's a tradition in my household every year at Halloween to watch this movie. It's called Young Frankenstein.
Mel Brooks.
You know, I mean, a lot of people at Christmas have to watch It's a Wonderful Life. I have to watch Young Frankenstein at Halloween. It's one of my favorite holidays. And I know it's one of yours as well.
It is. And this is one of my favorite movies. It's one of the funniest movies I think ever made.
It's true. Picture the movie. The movie comes on. The movie begins. Young Victor Frankenstein grandson of the count who started it all, returns by rail to his ancestral home. As the train pulls into the station, he spots a young boy on the platform, lowers the window, and asks, "Pardon me, boy, is this the Transylvania station?"
And you know where it goes from there.
It is the Transylvania station. Yeah. Yeah, and director Mel Brooks is home with Young Frankenstein, his best and most visually inventive film, which also happens to be very funny. Now, I think it helps if you've seen the original movies.
Definitely, because there are parts. Mel Brooks grew up a fan of the old 30s and 40s Universal horror movies.
Right.
And so you can tell that because the whole bit with Gene Hackman as the blind man, well, that's lifted from Bride of Frankenstein.
Right. Well, even some of the props
are listed. The set.
Right.
The set was the original 1931 set.
But the funny thing is I've talked to young people, and maybe not just young people, but people who, mostly young people, who have said to me, "I don't get it." And I said, "Have you seen the original Frankenstein or Bride of Frankenstein?" Well, no.
Well, and you have to remember that when Young Frankenstein came out in the late 70s, I believe.
74.
Mm-hmm. Oh, wow.
I know.
Wow. Okay, mid-70s. Mm-hmm. The Frankenstein movie, the first ones, Frankenstein, Bride of Frankenstein, Ghost of Frankenstein, those were 35 to 40 years old.
Exactly.
I mean, so most people had seen them on the late night show or seen them on re-release, so they were much more part of the popular culture conversation than I guess they are now.
I'm sure. But I recommend the old, you know, Frankenstein, Bride of Frankenstein to everyone. And if you can see them before you see Young Frankenstein, I think it'll make a big difference.
Yes.
You have Victor Frankenstein, who is a professor in a New York medical school who's trying to live down the family name and giving very funny demonstrations of the differences between voluntary and involuntary reflexes. Well, he stabs himself in the process, dismisses the class, and is visited by an ancient family lawyer with his grandfather's will. Well, Frankenstein quickly returns to Transylvania and the old ancestral castle where he's awaited by the faithful hunchback houseboy Igor, who of course pronounces his name
Igor.
Right. Now, as an example of how to properly plan your parody, Mel Brooks maintains a very serious tone throughout the movie. And as we were saying, he borrows liberally from the sets of the old James Whale classics. And the tone accurately mimics the melodramatic pitch of the subject matter. As you were saying, yeah, it's very close.
Oh, yeah.
You know, well, it's Gene Wilder, though, that holds it all together. His character's combination of arrogance and cluelessness are perfect for the movie.
We're talking about a show called Film Score Friday, so there's music in this movie as well.
Music by John Morse. Now, John Morse was born, Kyle, in New Jersey in 1926 and became interested in music by the time he was 3 years old. Now, he has to be one of the most undervalued American composers. The entire film industry stood up and took notice back in 1980 when Morse released the score for David Lynch's The Elephant Man. It's very different. It's an incredible score, and this would be John Morse's ultimate breakthrough before sinking back into a sea of some more mundane projects. Now, this was 1980. Now, the composer's early career was made easier thanks to Mel Brooks. Morse's first three compositions, the first one was called The Gamblers, from a movie in 1970, and then two Mel Brooks movies, The Producers, mm-hmm. which has been made into a Broadway musical, and 12 Chairs, and then later the same year, Young Frankenstein. Now, although Young Frankenstein has Mel Brooks' sense of humor, John Morse's music is a fine piece of dramatic scoring, the ambiguity being that the American film industry didn't seem to notice the score at all. And that score, those variations on a theme, are so important throughout the entire movie. And the music contains the most gorgeous violin sections, providing emotion for a film that the emotions would be non-existent.
Well, the narrative depends at some points on the music, because to lure Peter Boyle's the monster back.
Oh, always.
Thank you.
Now, Morris said he never, ever considered the fact that he was writing the music for a comedy. Rather, he was composing a very serious piece of music. And you can listen to it totally on its own and actually appreciate it even more. But it really, you know, you talk about film scores making movies. I mean, this was one of the serious points in this movie. I mean, it got a lot of laughs in a lot of different ways. For instance, when, you know, that we find out that the monster, you know, loves this music, and we hear the music, and then we see Frau Blücher actually playing the violin.
It's a Halloween edition of Film Score Friday, so I imagine there might be a few other monster-esque movies in there.
They're all Halloween movies. I Am Legend, mm-hmm. The Ghost and Mrs. Muir, Van Helsing, the original Uninvited, Hellraiser 3, Pan's Labyrinth, and Dracula.
And that's all tomorrow on Film Score Friday from 10 until noon.
Exactly.
Happy Halloween, PJ.
Same to you, Kyle.
This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums. With me back in the Anthony and Susan Hoy News Studio is Jody Bezoska, the Vice President of Communications for Walton Arts Center. Welcome back.
Thanks. Glad to be back.
You were out of town 1 week, and then...
Yes.
I talked to a cast member from Color Purple last week.
Yeah, it's been busy, but very glad to be back.
Heard great reviews about Color Purple,
by
the way.
Oh, Color Purple was wonderful. What a great show. And I was talking to some of the cast members just before they left, and they loved being here. They had a great time.
Now, we've got a one-night show tomorrow night at Walton Arts Center.
Yes, that's correct. This is great. This is the Academy of St. Martin in the Fields with Jonathan Biss on solo piano. And this is a chamber orchestra, a very famous chamber orchestra, and they generally play without a conductor. Their conductor either conducts from the first chair violin, or you know, their music direction happens from there, or Jonathan is playing on the piano and the music direction is coming from there. But this particular musical group has really gained a reputation as one of the best, and it's going to be a lovely evening. It's an all Mozart program, so we'll have the Divertimento in D major, we'll have Symphony No. 29 in A major, and the Piano Concerto No. 12 in A major. So it will just be a this is a classical music lovers show. You should come to this if you like Mozart. This is going to be a great night.
That's tomorrow night.
Tomorrow night at 8 p.m. Tickets are still available. You can get them at 443-5600 or online at waltonartscenter.org.
Monday and Tuesday, more music from the University of Arkansas.
More music. We have the University of Arkansas Scala Cantorum concert on Monday at 7:30, and we have the UA Inspirational Singers on Tuesday at 7:30. All tickets for all of those are available on our website. And then, believe it or not, we are into the third and fourth shows in our 10x10 art series, which kicked off so successfully a couple weeks back.
Trey McIntyre Project?
That's correct. Trey McIntyre Project on Friday the 5th. Shows at 8 o'clock. Wanted to talk a little bit about this one because I know we've talked about with the 10x10 art series about this idea of pre-show conversations and this opportunity to dig a little deeper and get involved more with the musicians or the artists. For Trey McIntyre, we have this really unique opportunity where if you come at 7 o'clock, the show starts at 8, if you come at 7 o'clock, we're going to be able to let you into the hall to watch them rehearse and warm up. So you'll go sit in the hall, you'll watch them rehearse for a little bit, and then the dancers may go back and get prepped, but Trey McIntyre, who's the choreographer, will come and answer do a Q&A for a few minutes before the show. So if you show up at 7, you'll get to be in the hall, you get to watch them prepare, you'll get to talk to Trey McIntyre, then you'll come back out into the lobby, and then in another few minutes you'll go back in and you'll watch the show.
I would think if you're a young person who has any thoughts about being a dancer, that would be a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity.
Absolutely. They are just... the Trey McIntyre Project, the people who run that organization are just so fun and interesting. They're young, they're dynamic, they're trying to change how people perceive dance. They're trying to take it out of this feeling that I don't understand it, or it's a language that I never grew up learning, and they're trying to bring it into a very contemporary place where you're comfortable with it, where anybody who likes to move can appreciate what they're seeing on stage. They're going to be doing master classes here in town, and they'll do some of them formally with dance studios, and then they'll do others that are available for people who just want to get up and move their bodies. And it's a really innovative and interesting company. And it goes across the whole company. It's not just their dance. It's their branding and their marketing. They want to be accessible. They're all over social media. They're very much about taking dance and bringing it to a new generation and making it fun. I mean, the featured piece they're going to perform is called Wild Sweet Love, and that features the music of Queen, Lou Reed, Roberta Flack, Felix Mendelssohn, and the Zombies, you know? So, I mean, how can you not love that? Yeah. And they're all young and interesting people who are going to be available to talk to you after the show. So we'll have a post-show party in the lobby after the show. So the musicians and the dancers will be out there, and it's just going to be great.
Most tickets, $10.
And they're going quickly. Our hope is that this one is sold out. And so if you would like to come, I would say get them now, because it's going to be a great night. It's going to be fantastic.
And then Bill Bryson.
Bill Bryson.
Coming to Walden Arts Center.
Oh, I'm so excited about Bill Bryson. I'm reading one of his books right now, and he's one of those authors that makes you laugh out loud. You know, you're reading along, and you're going, oh, that's funny. Oh, that's really funny. And he has a new book out. It's called At Home. Mm-hmm. And you might have seen him. He's been making the rounds of the talk shows, and he's been profiled in the big papers. But Bill Bryson is a... He's funny. He started off as a travel writer, but he's evolved into this. It's almost a little bit of commentary where he just kind of points out the funny things in life. And this, his new book At Home is, he tries to take his house and tries to construct the history of the world through the things in his house. So what about his bedroom? Can he learn about, what can he learn about history from his bedroom? And so his reading with us will be a reading followed by a Q&A, and then he will sign books. And so we're just thrilled to have him, because he's just funny. And he's a very, very highly successful author, good writer, and, well known all over the world.
It's the 15th of November,
and it's at 7 p.m., and tickets are available online, and you might want to check and see if there are special offers available on that. There might be some discounts out there for you.
And if the name sounds somewhat familiar, A Walk in the Woods. That's his big book.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay, well, catch your breath.
Yes.
Talk to you next week.
Absolutely. Thanks.
Thanks, Jody. Local support for Ozarks at Large comes from the University of Arkansas Fort Smith's 30th season of entertainment, continuing with the musical Fiddler on the Roof Tuesday night at 7:30 at the Arkansas Best Performing Arts Center. More information on online tickets at uafortsmith.edu. Barely any time left. This is KUAF 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Rogers, and Elkins. I'm Kyle Kellums. Ozarks at Large is a production of KUAF. Thanks so much for tuning in. Back tomorrow at noon with a new edition of Ozarks at Large.